This podcast contains explicit content and is not suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to Always the Last to Know. I'm Ash.
I'm Katie. Reading Corner with Katie. So I finished both Before We Were Innocent, which is the book I was talking about last time, which was a really, really great finish. It was a little bit predictable, but not in a bad way, and not like entirely. But I am really autistic, so I am pretty good at picking up plot lines. That being said, finished The Spare Room. Not only is it spicy, I had no idea where that book was going.
I love that.
It was just a 10 out of 10. Highly recommend. Highly recommend. It was really good.
I love a spicy book. A surprise spicy.
Surprise spicy. And it took place during COVID lockdown. Mm-hmm. It was nice kind of hearing someone process COVID in their head. It gave me a chance to kind of process lockdown in a way that like none of us have.
I feel like that must have been very validating.
It was.
Yeah.
It really was. It kind of goes through like the paranoia of that time really well, because it was like a mystery thriller suspense kind of thing. So it really builds. It's really great. So highly recommend. I just started Secluded Cabin Sleep 6. Spooky. Spooky, spooky, spooky. I'm enjoying them both immensely.
Nice. So, love that.
That's what I've got going on. I'm not really working as much, so I'm not reading as much.
Oh.
Started my fall shows again.
Yes. Yes. So,
you know, what's up, Charmed? How are you? You got your first business card.
I did. I got my first business card, and it looks so legit.
Oh, it really does.
Oh, my God. Oh, wait. When Helen was making the business cards and the template for it, we were trying to decide what we could put on mine that would be a better descriptor for the job that I actually do. Because right now, like my email signature says office manager. And that's kind of like what I always just say to people. But I think that my job definitely encompasses a lot more than that. So we were looking up a better phrase for it. And we found this insane list. So I'm going to see if I can find it really quick. Okay. Yes. I think this is it. Yes, this is it. Okay. Let me find it.
I'm so curious.
Number 19, workflow wizard.
Oh, hell yeah. Oh, hell yeah.
Workflow wizards figure out the best ways for everyone in the company to get their tasks done more efficiently. I do that. They look at how work is currently done, find any inefficiencies, and come up with solutions. That's my whole job. They also set up new tools and systems to help everyone keep track of their work easily. I do that. They make sure that from start to finish, you and your team's workday is as hassle-free as possible. That is literally my entire job.
I like how you're pretending that this is like a universal position that everyone has, and that this is the universal job description and not something someone just made up.
This is on a list called 35 Plus Creative Job Titles for Your Office Manager 2024.
Absolutely. Great list. But if you told someone that you're a workflow wizard, they're not going to know that this is the job description the same way that they would know office manager or whatever is on your actual business card.
So on my actual business card, it now says Chief Administrative Officer. And I feel so cool.
I know when I hear that, I'm like, oh. You definitely maintain the flow like a wizard.
Workflow wizard. We were cracking up at that one in the office, and I was like, if only we could, but we can't.
Dream.
Here's another one that was really funny. Connection Captain.
If someone ever told me that I was a connection captain, I would punch them in their corporate fucking faces. There's something so specific about the word captain that is so, like, yucky. This corporate job is my entire life. Like the way that when you work for Meta, they want you to call each other Metamates.
Wow.
Smokey Bones, where Mike works, they're fire starters.
Oh my god, stop. I can't.
Yeah, and that connection captain, that's the same fucking shit.
Yep. CC.
That same shit.
So, obviously, we went with Chief Administrative Officer. And you know what? I'm actually going to change my email signature to that because you I should. Deserve it. It's on my
absolutely.
It's on my business card.
It's on your business card.
Yeah.
Got to keep it consistent.
Oh, I got to change it on my like LinkedIn, on my Instagram. I love
gotta
this.
Put it the same across the board.
I feel so official. And you know what? It's so crazy. Like sometimes we were at Michael's the other day and Lauren and I were talking and I was like, it's actually crazy to me that I'm the adult in the room that everybody looks to at work. Because there's so many times where she literally looks at me and she's like, do whatever you want. Like you are in charge. You keep me in check here at work. I literally anticipate every single one of their needs. And it's kind of crazy. And I'm just standing there like, how am I the adult in this business?
Had to happen at some point. I mean, you were pretty adult at your last job too, though.
I was.
Like, this is, you know, you were in charge of a lot of shit. This is I think the first time that it's been life or death.
Literally.
It like feels a little bit more significant, but like you've been in charge of shit for a long time now.
I was basically the manager.
Yeah. You've been an adult in the room for a while.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like I'm cosplaying that position.
Oh, we all are.
Yeah.
We're all just making this up.
This is like the episode of Rugrats when Tommy and
Chucky are in the closet and they turn into grown-ups.
Yes. Yes. And then they're walking around tiny in their big suits. And I'm like, that's me.
That's all of us.
Yeah.
That's all of us.
That's me when I put my suit jacket on at work. I'm like, we're at a Comic-Con right now and I am cosplaying as an office manager.
As professional.
I have an update to my hiking list.
Oh, nice.
I have once again added another trail to the list. I just keep this to myself, so the list just keeps getting longer. Now we're at 29 on my list, and I've done 19 of them so far.
Nice.
And we're in September, which is great. I have quite a few on the list, and I know I'm definitely going to add a 30th one, because I was looking at the hotel grounds that I'm going to for my cousin's wedding in October in Vermont. Mm-hmm. They have an insane amount of acres of hiking trails as part of their property.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I think every property in Vermont does.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, where my grandpa's house is up there, yeah, they have their own trails too. I get up there on Friday, but like in the afternoon, and then the rehearsal dinner is that night. But the wedding ceremony, I don't think, is until like 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday. So I'm going to do a morning hike, and I'm going to add number 30 on there. And like, honestly, even if I don't complete all 30 trails this year, I'm super proud of myself for even having that many on the list and completing 19 so far. Like,
yeah, it's awesome.
When I did that hike to the Van Slyke Castle ruins a couple weekends ago with Amanda and Aunt, that was unintentionally 6.5 miles.
Yeah, dude.
I think because of the distance, that was one of the more difficult ones that I've taken. And then the hike back was so bad because that incline back up to the car was so steep.
You gotta bring food next time.
Yeah, we gotta bring food next time. I wish we did this time too. So Scott and I went to, in the Delaware Water Gap, we went to Worthington State Forest. For some reason, it seemed like this section of road was blocked off, but the trailhead was further down the paved road. So we just parked in a parking lot that was right there and then hoofed it with 1-year-old baby Jackson. And he was so good the whole time. But we like hoofed it down there, and that was like a good 3 miles there.
Damn.
And then back. Granted, it was like paved, but it was still a little bit of up and down. It was definitely quite a hike. And then I think we did like a mile up the trail and then a mile back. At some point it got to be too much with Jackson.
Oh yeah.
And then we headed back, but like, oh my God, we did 8 miles that day.
Yeah.
We did 8 miles that day. That was crazy. So that was the longest hike that I've done this year. And then I think technically, in all technical terms, I think it was the most difficult one that I've done, because the actual trail, once we got to the trailhead, the trail itself was very rocky. And then at one point when we got to the mines, it was very steep. So I was taking my time. I did not want my ankle to give out. I was nervous. Yeah. So I was being very careful. So I think that was like the most difficult trail that I've done this year. And it was pretty good. It's beautiful out there.
Oh, it looked gorgeous.
We found a bunch of coal because it used to be like a mine from the 1600s. The road that we walked on, that paved road, that is, I know I sent you and Spencer the back of the book, but that is considered the oldest road in America that was made for wheeled vehicles.
Which is wild.
Wild. It goes from like Kingston, New York to the Delaware Water Gap area. Absolutely incredible. So it was like all this history on top of it, like where we found the coal, there was the old ruins of the stone building where they would store all of it.
That's really cool.
Yeah. I took some coal home. You know what's really funny too? We were talking about, you remember that Randonautica app? We were talking about that on the way there, and we were talking about how you really needed to like set an intention before using it. And there was no service there, so we couldn't like do anything. But we were then setting our own intentions. And I was like, oh, you know, I'd love to find a crystal, because I brought some crystals with me to leave in place. We got to the coal pile and I just looked at it and I went, you know what? Close enough.
Close enough.
So I left a piece of hematite in its place.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's where I'm at on my hiking journey. That was really, really beautiful there. My ankle is holding up pretty well, but I mean, it gets sore. There's a lot of recovery in this, and I'm really proud of myself for how much I've done and how far I've come.
Hell yeah, dude, you should be. It's not easy coming back from a surgery like that, especially as we get older. I mean, sometimes I feel like not being able to do physical therapy because of COVID after my hands, like I think about it all the time, especially because my hands get so tired, or like mowing the lawn hurts, like shit like that. Like it is not easy to come back, especially on your foot when you like, oh, use that shit for everything.
Your hands too, dude. It's crazy. But we should be proud of ourselves for all we accomplish. Shall we get into the episode?
I guess. We left off with Arthur Sackler's death in 1987, and as we are following a lot of the highlights of his life that set the foundation for the corruption within the FDA and a culture of overprescriptions, it was a world where it seemed like these brothers were almost untouchable. But that's not to say that everything was going perfectly. There were countless memorials and celebrations of life for Arthur after he passed. His current wife and ex-wife spoke, amongst other colleagues and professionals all around the world. But noticeably missing from all of these celebrations behind that podium were both of his little brothers.
Oh, shit.
Neither spoke. Because by the time Arthur died, he was barely speaking to either of them. This is because of the way that that deal that we talked about played out. We don't have a ton of information about all of the nitty-gritty details of this agreement. But this is what Patrick R. Keefe was able to piece together in his book. Quote, while the agreement was made casually in the 1940s, during the 1960s, the four participants had engaged the attorney Richard Leather, who was a partner at the law firm Chadburn and Park, to formalize the pact. According to Leather, there were two written agreements, one governing domestic business and others governing international business. All four men were party to the domestic pact, which became known as the four-way agreement, but Arthur, for some reason, opted not to join the international agreement, so that became known as the three-way agreement between Raymond, Mortimer, and Froelich, end quote.
So we're talking about any money that they would make abroad. He didn't...
Yes. From any international companies, he wasn't going to be a part of that. which part of me wonders if he was really like, look, I've got plenty of fucking money in my American things. I don't need to deal with that also. I don't know. Or if this was like a conflict of interest thing that he was trying to avoid. I don't know. But for some reason, he was not part of the international aspect of this. When the deal was made, it was like the ad agencies, a few small businesses here and there. But by the time it was finalized in the 60s, things had changed pretty drastically. And one of the biggest changes that we haven't discussed, and one of the main sources of turmoil in the family, started in 1954, when the Fourth Musketeer, Bill Frolick, founded a company in New York called IMS. And IMS was like the missing link for the way that Arthur Sackler did not have his hands in the medical industry. So they were going to collect and organize pharmaceutical sales data, kind of gather the information on what drugs doctors were prescribing, and then put that, organize it, and sell that to companies to hone their marketing. I mean, this is a practice we're all familiar with now, but it was IMS that wanted to start that for the pharmacy. And on paper, officially, it was Frolick who started IMS. But just like Arthur had been the hidden mind behind so many other things, it appears that the company was actually Arthur's idea.
Oh.
Yes. Quote, reluctant to create another obvious conflict of interest, Arthur allowed Frolick to be his designated frontman and kept his own role in the company secret. End quote.
He's just dipping his little fingies into everything.
Everything. So he had his medical journals. He had Purdue Frederick. He had the ad agency. The last missing piece was understanding how all of this played out in sales.
Yeah.
And that's IMS. It's wild. We fast forward 16 years, and by 1970, this ad agency is, or not just McAdams, but his L.W. Frolick's ad agency, the rival to McAdams, was thriving. And they opened offices in London, Paris, Frankfurt, Milan, Madrid, and Tokyo. That whole business was like nearly $40 million in revenue. Like, tons of fucking money. And on top of that, IMS is also thriving. It's starting to be moved internationally as well. Everything's going really great until one day, quote, in 1971, Frolick returned from a Caribbean vacation and assembled his staff for a meeting, only to start babbling incoherently and then pass out, end quote. Frolick was diagnosed with a brain tumor.
Oh.
And rapidly, from his diagnosis, died in September of 1971 at the age of 58. And technically, under the agreement, Arthur should have inherited IMS alongside of his brothers. But his personal attorney, Michael Sonnenreich, was like, oh, no, no, no. You can't do that. That is such a conflict of interest. You're running McAdams. You can't do this. So he put his brothers in charge. Raymond and Mortimer had, quote, nothing to do with IMS, according to Sonnenreich, but they were parties to the agreement, and as a reminder, not for the first or even the second time, were serving the purpose of obscuring their brother's involvement, end quote. What's up, Patrick? This truly, Empire of Pain is a phenomenal book. There's so much more to it than everything I'm talking about. Absolutely go read it. Almost all of my quotes from this episode are from him. It's one of the best books I've ever read, hands down. So when all of this stuff, all of Frolick's things started to go public and started to kind of expand past his death, Frolick's family, his sister and her two daughters, received $6.25 million in total because their agreement had always said that they could set aside, quote, a reasonable amount of money to take care of their heirs.
Yeah.
So from that public thing, it going public, Raymond and Mortimer together made $37 million.
Wow.
Which today would have been $278,647,177.
That's insane.
That's an insane generational wealth. Generational.
Truly life-changing money.
Yeah. And again, that's from IMS, which Arthur was the idea man behind and only did not step in because his lawyer was like, that's a conflict of interest. That's going to look really bad. You can't do that. Arthur expected at this point that his little brothers, who he'd been uplifting forever, would cut him in. After all, quote, it had been him who had dreamed up IMS in the first place. The brothers had played no actual role in the company, end quote. Raymond's son, Richard, he's a huge piece of shit. He comes into this later and he's, fuck that guy. He tried to, like, throw in some revisionist history later by, like, casually dropping the, quote, four people who founded IMS, suggesting that, like, Raymond and Mortimer had played a role and that Arthur was, like, one of the four. But Patrick notes that Raymond himself told a journalist, Adam Tanner, quote, his involvement with IMS was negligible, saying, I knew very little, if anything, about that business. So according to Sonnenreich, under this agreement, Arthur, quote, gave away his rights to IMS, but his understanding with Froelich was that if it was ever sold, he would be entitled to a fourth of this domestic company. His brothers had completely different ideas. They claimed that because of the offices around the world, it's an international business, which Arthur was not party to. Quote, they moved the company out of the country. Oh. Arthur's son, Arthur Felix, would later explain, saying that his father was pissed off because he didn't get any participation. Wow. Which, if you think about it, that is a huge fucking slap to Arthur's face after everything that he's done for them.
That's bold.
And we've talked so much about how Arthur was a paternal figure to his younger brothers. But at the end of the day, if you really think about it, what that does is make a pretty big divide between Arthur and the two. Arthur the paternal and the two little brothers.
Yeah.
Then they're a pod. Quote, one of Arthur's son-in-laws, Michael Reich, said, to Arthur, Mortimer and Raymond had always been the little brothers following in his wake. He didn't think of them as equal to him. He felt he had to carry them. So their relationship slowly, but also very, very rapidly, deteriorated. He still would kind of intervene when they needed help, casually at Purdue. But for the most part, that was entirely their business of their own, where they were left to make their own investments, their own decisions, launch their own philanthropic initiatives, bring in their own money. And Patrick Arkeef notes that they brought in fucking plenty of it. The various business interests of the three brothers, quote, were very still much intermingled. The Medical Tribune ran ads for Purdue Frederick products in nearly every issue, and McAdams handled some of the advertising for it. After Arthur died, there were, quote, lawsuits and countersuits, affidavits and depositions, dozens of lawyers, thousands of billable hours, no stock share or hunk of sculpture went uncontested, end quote. Between all of Arthur's three wives and four children, everything was fought over, and it went on for years.
Money really ruins you.
Oh, 100%. So, like, at one point in 93, one of the kids tried to prepare for, like, a major auction of Arthur's collection, only to be forced to cancel last minute when one of the ex-wives got an injunction to stop it. By one estimate, quote, the litigation over the estate cost the Sacklers more than $7 million.
What?
But the real figure was likely much higher, end quote. Years they argued over this man's fortune. And because all these lawyers are, like, looking through everything, they find the agreement to pass everything on, as well as the slow abandonment of said agreement. There wasn't any conversation about Raymond and Mortimer inheriting everything. You know, they were pretty, not reasonable, but, like, well aware of how they fucked him over. But their biggest interest was what happens to his ownership, his third of Purdue Frederick. And Mortimer and Raymond wanted to buy the whoever got it out. They wanted to own that. And it is so important to note that Arthur's heirs did end up selling their 1/3 stock interest in Purdue Frederick to Mortimer and Raymond for $22 million.
Wow.
His son, Arthur Felix, drifted away from his parents, then drifted back. He worked for McAdams for a little bit and then for the Medical Tribune, but then eventually got involved in his mom's family's drug company back in Germany. His other daughter, his daughter Denise, had like a remote relationship in California. She got married. Carol is a doctor in Boston. And then his other daughter, Elizabeth, is in New York and has like a very philanthropic, artistic life. I believe she's like a feminist artist. So none of his children had any interest in continuing his legacy whatsoever.
Wow. That's wild.
Arthur's contribution to the main opioid epidemic was entirely covered in the last episode. So now we're going to focus on the two younger brothers and their children. And in order to do that, we just need to go back in time a wee little bit to when Arthur was alive. But by his own account, Purdue Frederick was mostly under the control of Mortimer and Raymond.
Okay.
So it's 1966 when Mortimer is overseeing the purchase of a British drug company called Knapp.
Is that with a K?
No, N-A-P-P.
Oh. Okay.
And they were going to work in tandem with Purdue back in New York. The origins of this company go back to like the 1920s, and it's not just a business that licensed products to sell. They also create new drugs of their own, which okay. Purdue Frederick wasn't really doing at the time. And in the late 1970s, Knapp produced a new product that was genuinely new and amazing. It was a morphine pill.
Oh.
A hospice in London, quote, called St. Christopher's, which was run by Cicely Saunders, a crusading physician, who had written a book called The Care of Dying and pioneered a new palliative care movement, arguing that the medical establishment should provide a more compassionate environment for the terminally ill patients to die in. At St. Christopher's, Saunders had appointed a doctor named Robert Twycross to research the use of narcotics in palliative care, and eventually Twycross met with Knapp's medical director and urged him to develop a morphine pill. Prior to this, it was only used intravenously, whether it was through an IV or a shot, making it so that patients with late-stage cancer had no choice but to spend their final days in the hospital in order to be given the medication, the only medication that can give them any sort of comfort. So what Knapp had done was they didn't change anything about morphine. They had actually developed a special coating for the pills that, quote, allowed for the diffusion of the drug into the bloodstream of a patient to be carefully regulated over time. And they called that system continuous.
Like a time release.
They literally invented time release.
That's amazing.
That's them.
That's, yeah. I took time release ADD meds when I was younger.
A lot of people do. This new drug would become known as MS Contin, C-O-N-T-I-N, and it's released in the UK in 1980, and this is a fucking breakthrough. Think about also the 80s. We're going to be coming up on the AIDS epidemic. Having this pill changes pain management. So in 1983, the London Times quoted one physician describing the new drug as, quote, among the most important advances in narcotics this century. With another saying that it represented the most important step forward in drug control of pain since morphine itself. The Sacklers were, understandably, hugely proud of this achievement, boasting that the continuous delivery system had revolutionized the administration, not just of morphine, but of drugs in general. And this drug just happened to come together at the same time that a new federal regulation was in the works that would forbid the, quote, grandfathering in of new twists of old drugs without a new FDA standard drug application.
Oh.
So when the lawyer, Howard Udell, learned that this new regulation is coming, he was like, yo, Purdue, we need to get this out now. So let's make MS Contin and put it on the market. And that was according to a former executive who worked with him during this period. So without talking to the FDA, they just started manufacturing this pill in New Jersey and started offering it for sale in October of 1984. We're in the U.S. now. And putting this in the U.S. now puts this under Raymond's territory because Mortimer is handling more of the international stuff. Mm-hmm. He's the one who bought this company. And Raymond is doing U.S. areas. And at this point in time, it also includes his right-hand man, his son, Richard. Richard had joined Purdue in 1971 as an assistant to his father and like rapidly worked his way up. So at the launch of this new drug in the United States, it is actually all about Richard because there is this huge sense amongst everyone who's there that Richard Sackler was personally invested in this drug and the future of Purdue. The sales team took to the ground selling this drug to doctors across the country. It's a bold new tool for, you know, treating cancer, even though this drug does not have FDA approval. Like, they haven't even talked to the FDA about this.
That's wild.
So fucking bold. So it's been on sale for 3 months when the FDA sends a letter to Purdue being like, yeah, no, you guys had no right to do this.
What do you think you're doing?
What the fuck? You have to file for a, you know, new drug application. And the lawyer and his squadron of attorneys were like, no, we don't. It's just, it's a twist on already approved morphine. And they were like, no, you're putting this in pills, in quantities. It's completely different. This is not okay. You need to file for a new application. So in theory, Purdue was in trouble. And in order to solve this, it would be a very long process, recalling the drug, starting all over, following the rules, filling out an application. It's an extensive back and forth thing with the agency. Yeah. And if they're lucky, then they can launch. But they had started giving these pills to hundreds of thousands of dying cancer patients. To the point where the head of the FDA was worried that, quote, it might be damaging to abruptly yank this course of therapy.
That's exactly what I was just thinking before you said it. Like, how are you going to just stop cold turkey giving that to people who, like, need it?
Who are dying.
It'll be fucked up.
And the lawyers just kept insisting, like, this is a misunderstanding. This is a misunderstanding. Even though the FDA was like, this is a new product. What are you doing? So eventually, quote, Purdue went over the agency's head, appealing to the political leadership in the Reagan administration. They were putting pressure on the White House, an executive said, and the strategy succeeded. The FDA ultimately told Purdue that the company could continue to sell the drug so long as they now submitted the application that they were supposed to have done. Purdue would keep marketing MS-Contin. Udell announced triumphantly, FDA will not interfere. End quote.
That's wild. They kind of just like bullied them.
They fully bullied into the it. FDA. 100%.
You went to the top dog in the country.
Yeah. And they were like, but we're helping. We're helping people.
I mean, you were, but you're also trying to spin a profit, so.
Oh, absolutely. When Arthur was alive, Mortimer and Raymond were able to come together by opposing him. But when he died, quote, significant divisions emerged between the two younger brothers themselves. During board meetings, the brothers would sit on opposite sides of the table and argue viciously, swearing at each other in full view of the board. Mortimer had volatile temperament, and for all his surface gentility, Raymond was very stubborn. On one occasion, the brothers fought with such rancor at a board meeting that they physically came to blows, throwing punches at each other. What? One of them missed and hit a lawyer.
That's not good. You can't hit the lawyer.
This leaves it very difficult for anything to get done. So in Mortimer's place, his daughter Kathy starts acting as a mouthpiece. Quote, as Mortimer's proxy, Kathy would routinely check in with people, requesting an update for Dr. Mortimer. She and her father had similar handwriting, which meant it could occasionally be difficult to tell which of them was represented on a piece of paperwork. And Richard, meanwhile, was increasingly a proxy for his own father, though Raymond was still in the building and in full control of the firm. Whatever's going on between the parents is happening with the kids. Raymond and Mortimer hate each other. Kathy and Richard hate each other and are fighting. Well, it seemed like the brothers, quote, the older generation could seem regal and out of touch at times, the children were less benign. They were somehow worse than the people fighting in the boardroom. I'm not sure what that quote really means, because it didn't sound like the brothers could keep it together. But it was insisted in the book, so here we go. This is not stable ground amongst the company or the family. Nevertheless, they push forward.
I'm like, this sounds like a nightmare situation, to be honest, and I would hate to be in that boardroom.
Oh, absolutely. And it fully is the House of Usher. One of the big reasons that Purdue Fredericks even went into pain management is because of Richard. In 1994, he helped create and organize a conference in Toronto, the International Symposium on Pain Control, held at the University of Toronto's Medical School and sponsored by Purdue. Of course, MS content was brought up, soon to be released in the US. So, you know, it was definitely a teaser. But the idea was that any gap that existed in pain treatment could be filled with MS content. So the goal was to offer like a more approachable delivery for morphine, the pill. And everyone at the conference was being propagandized, essentially, that morphine is an excellent treatment that's not being used enough. Yeah, sure, there might be a perception that morphine is potentially addictive, but according to the doctors in Toronto, such fears were misplaced.
Okay.
Addiction does not occur in patients requiring morphine for pain control. One of the speakers, a doctor from Austria named Eckhard B. Blair. I genuinely don't know where they're getting this idea from, whether it's just a lack of knowledge or blinded by the bills.
Or both.
Or both. Outside of this, the world as a whole was really starting to move into the next phase of pain management, was the idea of compassionate care. There's this movement to look at the way that doctors are treating pain or not treating chronic pain, and trying to push away that into acknowledging the care that is needed for chronic pain havers. So doctors like Cicely Saunders, the hospice care advocate in London, argued that patients are being forced to suffer unnecessarily because clinicians don't want to take pain seriously. They talk about how pain is one of the most common symptoms that patients have. Richard would talk about how the challenge is that pain is super subjective. You can't just look at a doctor or you can't just look at a patient and know how much pain they're in. You have to depend on the patient's report. This message is being repeated through this event, through different doctors all over the world, that we need to fix pain. And that at this event, they're talking about how morphine can be used to treat pain. And when it is being used to treat actual pain, it's not going to be addictive.
That's not how it works.
No. No. MS Content would go on to make $170 million a year in sales, dwarfing anything that this Purdue Frederick had ever sold in the past. But slowly, its patent was coming to an end. Like we talked about in the last episode, you can only have that patent for 20 years before generic pills can start being created of it. So this sends Purdue Frederick onto the hunt for a new drug. Over a business dinner one night in Connecticut, Kathy alleges that she suggests using oxycodone, an opioid that had been synthesized in Germany in 1917. According to Kathy, Richard did not know what oxycodone was, so she told them it's another opioid, a chemical cousin of morphine and also of heroin, but oxycodone is much more potent than morphine. Richard himself has a very different recollection of this pivotal moment in the company's history. Quote, the project started in the late 80s, he said, and according to Richard, it was Bob Kayoko's idea, not Kathy's. Hmm. And there is a 1990s memo that shows Kayoko did suggest oxycodone, saying that it was less likely to initially have generic competition. Regardless, the thinking was this. The drug was already kind of known and available as a painkiller, but in much more mild treatments like Percocet. But there's only a small amount of oxycodone in Percocet. It's laced with aspirin or acetaminophen, which can both be toxic if a person has too much. So they're like, all right, if we have oxycodone, but it's with the Contin system, we might be able to administer a larger dose that filters slowly into the bloodstream, allowing patients to take said larger dose of oxycodone. They're like, okay, that could work. Richard is rapidly rising through the company. He officially joins the board in 1990, along with his brother Jonathan and Kathy and her sister Eileen. The following year, the family created a new company, Purdue Pharma. And while Purdue Frederick would continue to exist, handling the traditional over-the-counter remedies, Purdue Pharma is going to be the one that takes on the, quote, risk of new products. In 1993, Richard ascends to the position of senior vice president. The family had looked as if it could be really successful with this project that they've been working on for a while. They decided to call it OxyContin. And an OxyContin project team memo, December of 1993, noted that the new pills would be marketed against Percocet and might ultimately replace our MS Cotton line if the generic competition becomes unsustainable. And it had a high potential to be really effective for cancer pain. And I know it feels like now we're moving really quickly through time, but that's really because the creation of drug is a very slow business. So it takes a long period of time to kind of get these things moving. So we fast forward to 94, and this PR guy that Richard had hired, Michael Friedman, wrote this very confidential memo to Raymond, Mortimer, and Richard. And he was like, all right, so the market for cancer pain is pretty significant. About 4 million prescriptions per year. In fact, 750,000 prescriptions just for MS Cotton alone. But they were like, we think that the FDA is going to restrict our initial launch for OxyContin to the cancer pain. And Friedman was like, but what if we could, quote, over time, get the drug extended beyond that. There's a much greater market for other types of pain, back pain, neck pain, arthritis, fibromyalgia. According to a wrestler turned pain doctor, John Bonica, 1 in 3 Americans was suffering from untreated chronic pain. If that was even somewhat true, it represented an enormous untapped market. What if you could figure out a way to market this new drug, OxyContin, to all of those patients? The plan would have to remain secret for the time being, but in his memo to the Sacklers, Friedman confirmed that the intention was to expand the use of OxyContin beyond cancer patients to this chronic, non-malignant pain, end quote. Much like Arthur and his minor tranquilizers, Arthur's brothers and his nephew are about to make the same exact pivot with this drug. They realized if we can figure out a way to market OxyContin that it's not just for cancer, but for any pain at all, the profits are going to be astronomical. Friedman told the Sacklers that it was imperative that we, quote, establish a literature to support this kind of positioning. They would suggest OxyContin for the broadest range of use. End quote. The only hurdle that stood in their way was that oxycodone was roughly twice as potent as morphine.
Oh my God.
Which was 6 times as potent as heroin, if you recall. As a consequence, OxyContin would be a much stronger drug than MS Cotton. And American doctors are still very, very tentative in giving people opioids because of the, quote, long-established concerns about the addictiveness of these drugs. End quote. I mean, for years, people were like, yeah, of course MS Cotton works for end-of-life care when someone is in a mortal battle with cancer. We don't care about them getting addicted to morphine. But when someone is dealing with chronic back pain, that's pretty fucking important. But that stigma is going to block OxyContin from getting to its full potential. So the Sacklers had to undo that perception. Richard devoted himself to this new project, quote, with a fervish energy. "You won't believe how committed I am to make OxyContin a huge success," he wrote to his friend. "It's almost that I dedicated my life to it," end quote. And how do you, right? And how do you get rid of a stigma that exists entirely based on fact? Marketing perception. Market research showed the team that many physicians regarded oxycodone as weaker than morphine. And for some reason, it was less well known and thus not as understood. Meaning, quote, "it had a personality that seemed less threatening and more approachable," end quote. From a marketing standpoint, that's a huge opportunity. Mm. They could easily market OxyContin as a safer and less extreme alternative, regardless of the fact that it's way stronger.
So basically lie.
A century earlier, Bayer had done the same thing with heroin, as we talked about it. They created this thing without the unpleasant side effects. And even though all of this was more powerful and every bit as addictive, all you had to do is market it the right way. So now, internal discussions at Purdue headquarters, Richard and his colleagues entertained a similar notion and a similar marketing strategy. There was an anecdotal study done that all it really showed was that people can develop a very high tolerance to OxyContin. I hesitate to even really talk about it or to call it a study, but at one point there was someone who was quote unquote studying this drug and gave someone 1,000 milligrams of OxyContin and they were fine
because
their body built up such a tolerance to it. So from that study, they essentially were like, there's no limit to how much of this stuff you can take. But in order for any of this to actually matter, Purdue had to get the FDA to approve OxyContin. In particular, they needed to get the approval of a man, quote, named Curtis Wright, who oversaw pain medication at the agency and would be the medical reviewer and chief inquisitor in charge of approving OxyContin. So they were going to sell it as a scheduled narcotic under the Controlled Substance Act of 1970. As with any strong opioid, there, you know, has the possible addictive potential that, you know, they've got a lot of things that they've got to prove to the FDA that are okay. You would think that Purdue would have conducted tests to the addictive properties of its drug, but they didn't. Instead, they argued that because of the patented Contin system, there's no risk of addiction. Because the whole idea of addiction to opioids is that you get a huge blast of high from taking them. But because of the way that the system works, you can only get so much an hour. So you can't get the euphoric high. Thus, you can't. It's controlled. It's a controlled release. He was right in the sense that swallowing the pill would not get you high, so people just crushed it up and snorted it. But as someone who loves drugs, who loves painkillers specifically, and has been physically dependent on them before, you don't need to tell me how to do it. I'll figure it out.
Yep.
Put me in a room with drugs, I'll figure out how to fucking do them. Like, this is so dumb. Curtis Wright was like, no. And the FDA was like, I don't know. I don't know about that. Curtis Wright cautioned that it might be bridged too far for Purdue to claim that OxyContin was actually safer than other available painkillers, quote, warning the company that care should be taken to limit the competitive promotion. He also told officials at Purdue that some of his colleagues at the FDA had very strong opinions that opioids should not be used for non-malignant pain. There are more and more memos listed in Empire of Pain from Michael Friedman, the PR person, to the Sackler shitholes that talk about just how much they knew this was bad and how they knew that they needed to tweak their words just right. It's really terrifying, but one that I want to highlight the most is the idea that once a company gets approval for a drug, a doctor can prescribe it for anything they want. It doesn't have to just be this. So once this hits the market, it's out there. And it's important to note that it's not just the pill itself that's being approved, it's the claims in the little insert packaging and what it says about the pill that's also being approved. It's that insert that's so important because that's what tells you all of the rules about it and like side effects and all of that stuff. The insert was revised more than 30 times, with Purdue's experts haggling with the government and poring over each word and phrase.
I don't know exactly what he means by this, so I can't ask further, but hopefully the rest of my notes will explain. Quote, it didn't take long for Purdue to cultivate right. They're at a conference, and a Purdue official, Robert Redder, who plays a key role in overseeing the application process for OxyContin, just happened to bump into Curtis, right, in Washington in 1992. And they just happened to get to talking about OxyContin. And an internal Purdue memo about this interaction says that Wright, quote, agreed to more such informal contacts in the near future. Richard had to gloat about how far we've come in building a positive relationship with Wright and the agency. Sometimes Wright would instruct Purdue to send him certain materials to his home office rather than the FDA. According to a confidential memo that was subsequently prepared by federal prosecutors, at one point, a small delegation of Purdue officials traveled to Maryland and rented a room near Wright's office. Then, in a highly unusual step, the team from Purdue spent several days helping Wright compose the reviews of clinical study reports and the integrated summaries of the safety of their own drug. At times, it could be seen that Wright had entirely given up his impartial federal regulator and become a sort of in-house advocate for Purdue.
This is incredibly unethical.
This is illegal.
Yeah, this is insane.
The package insert went through endless drafts and iterations, and at some point, a new line of text crept into it. This is a quote within the quote, because this whole thing that I'm reading is a giant quote from Patrick Braden Keefe. Delayed absorption, as provided through OxyContin tablets, is believed to reduce the abuse liability of the drug. This is a peculiar bit of rhetoric. It is believed. Believed by whom? End quote. Somehow, in all of this stuff, the phrasing that OxyContin is believed to be non-addictive, essentially, made it into the insert packaging for these pills, and it was approved by the FDA. Later, no one is willing to take claims for who puts this in the insert. In a sworn deposition, Wright allowed that he might have done it. It was possible, but he had no specific memory of doing so.
I cannot recall.
Basically. Even though at the time, this language prompted immediate skepticism from the FBA. FBA? What? FDA? Sounds like BS to me. One of Wright's colleagues, Diane Schnitzler, told him in an email. Actually, Diane, this is literally true. Wright wrote back, one important factor in abuse liability determination is how fast the hit is from a drug. This drug was approved in 11 months and 14 days, unlike the years that other filings linger at the FDA. Richard admitted to feeling very satisfied in having, quote, personally had a lot to do with the quality of the package insert, but he also credited the unparalleled teamwork between Purdue Pharma and the FDA, end quote.
Teamwork. Okay.
They're supposed to be, like, overseeing you. You're not supposed to be a team. After the approval went through, weirdly enough, Curtis Wright left the FDA. And barely a year later, where did he move on to? His new position at Purdue Pharma. With a first-year compensation package of nearly $400,000.
Wow.
In a subsequent testimony, Wright denied making any overtures to Purdue before he ultimately took the job, insisting that he was approached by a headhunter only after he had left the FDA.
Sure, Jan.
The truth is that, quote, one of Wright's first calls in his new job at Adler had been to Purdue to seek out any areas where they might be collaborative. And Richard Sackler, in his own subsequent sworn deposition, maintained that it was Wright who first approached the company about the possibility of a job, and that he did so before he had even left the government.
Oh.
He spoke to somebody at Purdue when he was planning on leaving the FDA, Richard recalled. But at this time, Richard felt like this might not be a good look for the company. He discussed it with a colleague, and they agreed that we should not hire somebody who reviewed our product. Richard figured a year would be enough cooling off time to have Wright join them. End quote. Now that we know how OxyContin was made and approved, my next episode on this, we will join into the rapid rise and subsequent fall of Purdue Pharmaceuticals.
Ooh. I'm excited, Katie.
Isn't this shit fucking wild? How many times are the Sacklers gonna fuck with the FDA? Yeah.
So, until next time.
Bye.
Bye.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
For any photos related to today's episode, please go to our Instagram.
You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at AL2KPodcast.
Like us on Facebook at Always the Last to Know Podcast.
If you have any questions, please email us at AL2KPodcast@gmail.com.
Please share, rate, and review us on your podcast listening app of choice.
Join our Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/AL2KPodcast or click the link in our bio on social media.
Thanks for listening.